Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Dirk Bierman. My registration number is 11,189. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Jerry Jeanette. This is a wage claim and contract case, and the wage claim is found at Exhibit 32. And when I wrote that wage demand in December of 2007, I thought the matter would be resolved within a month, but that was only because of the upcoming holiday season. It's a contract actually involving a pretty simple contract, and those are Exhibits 1 and 2, and they were attached as Appendix B to the plaintiff's brief. They were also attached to my demand letter, and those documents make up the terms of the agreement that Mr. Jeanette sued under and have always been the contract that he's based his action on. And frankly, after reading the appellee brief, there really are very few facts that are in much dispute. The facts are pretty much in agreement. Mr. Jeanette was VP of facilities management for this corporation, Genesis, and he was the guy who negotiated leases and subleases. He consolidated sites, he shut down sites, and he took care of physical moves. When the company reorganized in 2003, they sent him a termination notice and a offer of severance with the release. But then somebody figured out, and that offer, that's Exhibit 2, contains a 45-day time to consider. Somebody figured out that his services were going to be needed through this reorganization, and that they needed him to negotiate leases and subleases, consolidate sites and shut down sites and take care of physical moves. And so they requested that he stay. They asked him, they needed to retain him. And in connection with that, the place ultimately negotiated a retention bonus and severance agreement. And that's Exhibits 2 and 3. At the advice of the president of the company, Mr. Jeanette got it in writing. And over the course of several months, negotiated with the Vice President of Human Resources. Again, we've attached those exhibits to the brief at Exhibits 4 and 9. And ultimately came up with the agreement. And the defense has always seemed to be that there is that the agreement expired at the end of 2004. That's basically their defense throughout, and that there was also an assertion that there really wasn't an agreement, although what happened was the case went to trial and the jury did find that there was an agreement and decided in favor of the plaintiff on that issue based upon the jury instructions, which included an instruction, jury instruction number 11, which is found at page 2820 of the record, that in order to find for plaintiff on his claims for breach of a contract, you must find that Genesis and Jerry Jeanette entered into a contract that provided that if Jerry Jeanette's position was eliminated at any time, then the terms and conditions of the March 26, 2004 Memorandum of Understanding would apply. And based upon these instructions, the jury rendered its verdict, and that's in the record at page 2841-42, finding that there was indeed a contract, but also not awarding the damages or the benefits that are specifically outlined in the parties' agreement.
Excuse me, counsel, let me ask you a question. The jury found that there was a contract. Is there a dispute between the parties that the contract consists of the 2004 amended MOU and the terms and conditions of the severance as stated in the November 21st, 2003 severance agreement?
No, Your Honor, there never was until the appellate brief was filed in this action. The case was tried entirely on the theory that we're, based upon plaintiff's claims, this is our contract, this is what we're suing on, and it was also, and that was what the defendants tried the case as well on those documents, but asserting that, in effect, that really wasn't a contract or that it expired.
Well, the 2003 document was never signed by Mr. Jeanette.
No, it was never signed, but it is incorporated into the 2004 memorandum of understanding. In other words, the memorandum of understanding outlines the terms and agreements, the terms of the players' agreement, and says you will be provided with the benefits as outlined in the original severance agreement. And there was no, this case was tried under the theory that that was the contract. There was no assertion that there was some other contract out there that the jury could somehow latch onto and award something different than what was in the players' agreements.
Mr. Bierman, I may interrupt you, please.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you a question about the damages verdict. It's your contention that the damages verdict is inconsistent. Am I correct in that?
Yes, it's inconsistent with the evidence.
If I may ask you a hypothetical, I want you to tell me what's wrong with the following jury reasoning. All jurors agree that there is a breach. They all say, yes, there was a breach. So there's no dispute about that. But the jurors start talking and they say, okay, they've asked for a variety of different damages, but says one juror, I think that they should only get a quarter of it. And another juror says, oh, I think that they should get three quarters. And eventually, they compromise at 50%. What's wrong with that?
It's a compromise verdict, and it's not supported by the evidence.
Is it a compromise verdict if there is no disagreement about in this case, the breach? They're compromising about damages. There's no issue about I'll go along with liability or the breach if you'll lower the damages. They all agree. But you would say that that's still a compromise verdict?
Yes, it's a compromise, and it is. And in fact, it's not for the jury ultimately to determine, because the issue of contract interpretation is for the court, including this court, to determine de novo on the review of the documents itself. And absent any ambiguity in the agreement, the contract should be interpreted as written, including all of its provisions, including those provisions which outline the promises that were made, and the promises in this case were made that you would receive severance, retention bonus, which was a big contention here, because what the company was doing was promising to pay Mr. Jeanette to stay and get these jobs done.
Pardon me, counsel, but if that is so, why not simply submit the issue of breach to the jury and then have the court determine damages based upon what you just said? Why have the jury look at damages at all?
That was the way it was framed, and that was the way it was argued in jury instructions. I agree. I think that would be the way to ultimately resolve it, was to have the judge determine it. And what the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict did, provided that to the judge to give him the opportunity to correct that, interpret the contract as written, and provide the damages that would be based upon the promises that were made in the agreement.
Counsel, but you'll agree that the jury has given some affirmative defense.
Yes, sir.
So as instructed, the jury could have determined, for example, consistent with the affirmative defenses, that the time off policy only allowed for 80 hours to be carried over, and therefore the total amount that your client had accrued within the meaning of the 2004 memorandum was 160 hours.
Actually, the affirmative defenses were pled as total affirmative defenses. They were not pled as partial. And in fact, the way the jury was instructed in instruction number 11 was, if you find in favor of the plaintiff on these three points, you must find in favor, you must consider the affirmative defenses. And then instruction number 11 read each of those affirmative defenses. And they were not argued in partial, in part.
And that brings up a question I have on instruction 11. Just what you were talking about, each one of those affirmative defenses were indicated in the second part of instruction number 11. But instruction number 11 goes on to say, if you find that any one or more of these affirmative defenses has been proved by preponderance of the evidence, then your verdict must be for the defendant. So it would seem that the jury appeared to find in the defendant's favor on one or more of those affirmative defenses, and yet still awarded your client $55,000 on one of your claims. When it was instructed not to award anything, it was instructed to enter a verdict for the defendant if any one or more of those affirmative defenses had been proven.
We had no way of knowing what the jury was thinking. But in any event, it is, again, going back to the court to decide if there's an ambiguity with respect to any of these terms. And with respect to the issue of, for instance, of the vacation pay, if there was an ambiguity with respect to vacation pay as and whether or not it included the use it or lose it policy or not, then it would be up to the defense to raise that issue. This is ambiguous, and we request from the jury a special finding regarding resolving that ambiguity. That did not occur here. And I submit that, frankly, there was an ambiguity because the agreement says all accrued unused vacation. It doesn't say all accrued unused vacation subject to the company's policy. It says all accrued unused vacation. And it's our position that that's simple. That was what was a bargain for, and that's what should have been included in the award based upon the party's unambiguous agreement.
So one question I have focuses, I want to focus on the advance notice provision. I see that it's in there as part of the list of terms and conditions that's included in the 2004 memorandum. Is that right? Yes, it does.
Yes.
Right here.
So,
okay,
yes,
it's a separate clause, 30 days advance notice. What I'm concerned about, I guess, is the measure of damages for breach of that. It's not apparent to me that the measure of damages should be one day's wage for each working day that was not included in the 30-day period. I mean, I presume that the advance notice provision is worth something, but did you advance some alternative measure of damages? What was the evidence on the value of a breach of the advance notice clause?
The evidence was limited to the amount of earnings that the plaintiff would have earned during those days that the notice provision wasn't met. And we were very careful there not to overreach. What happened was the company even overpaid based upon their theory because they paid through the end of the pay period, which happened to go into the next year, 2008. And we asked for only those paydays that he would have been paid on, not for the full 30 days. In other words, only 20 of the working days within that 30-day period. But that is the measure of damages because he was entitled to the 30 days notice. He was entitled to wages during those 30 days. So, nope.
I just wonder if there's an alternative way of looking at it. If you posit that his termination date is the same day, no matter what, then the failure to have notified him 15 days earlier doesn't necessarily mean that he's entitled to 8 more days of wages.
But the failure to notify was the breach.
Yeah, so
it starts from that date. I would submit that it starts from that
date. They were required to keep him around, in other words, until 30 days.
At least provide him with payment during the time that the notice period was in effect. And I reserve my 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Christopher A. Taravella, Montgomery, Little, and Soren, appearing for Genesis Conferencing. It's an honor and privilege to be before this court. My bar number is 7790. May it please the court. Your Honors, this case was never tried as an all-or-nothing-at-all proposition. In fact, it was tried on the basis of an a la carte menu, Plaintiff's Exhibit 36, that was submitted by the plaintiff to the jurors. It was hotly contested. In fact, whether or not there was indeed any contract at all was hotly contested. If there was a contract, what was it, going to Judge Hawthorne's question, what was the contract? And I would respectfully assert that to this day, we don't know exactly what the breach was, but every drawing every reasonable inference in favor of the jury's verdict, I think we can deduce what they did. What are the terms of the contract? What is the term, I should say? What are the provisions of the contract? What are the meaning of ambiguous terms of the contract? For example, retention bonuses, counsel indicated, was hotly contested, the meaning of it. And it varied depending on the facts and circumstances of Genesis and the economic conditions it was facing. So,
excuse me, Mr. Taravella.
Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt you, but we know that the jury found that there was a contract because they found a breach of that contract. But what you're saying is, I think what you're saying is we don't know what they found to be the contract.
Exactly.
Is that right?
And if you look at the special verdict form drafted by the plaintiff, Your Honor, it doesn't exactly ask the jury. The closest we can come to deduce what they did is a special verdict form with special interrogatories. That was not done. For whatever reason, the plaintiff didn't do that. So I would ask that the court defer to the jury's verdict and draw every reasonable inference that we should draw from them, and absent just something totally outlandish, not supported by the jury's verdict, it should support it. Now, yes, Your Honor, I think the most reasonable interpretation of what happened here is that the February 2004 MOU, as amended by the March 2004 MOU amendment, and the November 2003 contract, that was the contract. And basically it said that if your job is eliminated in 2004, certain things will happen. For example, you will get a retention bonus, but you will not get certain things if your job is not eliminated in 2004, like you will not get the retention bonus. And by the way, if your job is eliminated at any time, you get severance. I think that's the most reasonable interpretation of what happened, but we don't have to go there to support that jury verdict.
Let me tell you my concern with that interpretation. In instruction number 11, the jury was told that the plaintiff had to prove three elements to prevail on his claim. First, that the parties entered into a contract which provided that if the position were eliminated at any time, then the terms and conditions as stated in the March 26, 2004 Memorandum of Understanding would be honored. So it seems to me that if the jury determined, as it did in answering question number two, that plaintiff prevailed on, he proved his claim for breach of contract, that they necessarily determined that if the position were eliminated at any time, then the terms and conditions as stated in the MOU would be honored. So doesn't that necessarily include all the terms and conditions as stated in the MOU?
That goes to the very essence of this a la carte menu theory that we advanced to trial, Your Honor. And looking at instruction number 11, we're attaching a lot of words here to the word the. Then the terms and conditions as stated in the March 26, 2004 Memorandum of Understanding Amendment would be honored. That is, one way to read it is then all of the terms and conditions. And I'm reminded of UN Resolution 242 of whether or not Israel would have to give up occupied territories or deoccupied territories. That was the whole debate. I think we don't need to attach that much significance to the word the in paragraph one of the instruction for a lot of reasons. One of which is the special verdict form, if Your Honor goes to that, special verdict form, paragraph one, was there a contract between plaintiff and defendant which provided that defendant would pay plaintiff certain wages and other benefits as opposed to the? All right, so that has to be read, number 11, I respectfully submit to the court, with the special verdict form. Then also, going to one of the court's questions, we advanced affirmative defenses that were, if you will, rifle shots at various portions of the case.
I absolutely understand that part of your argument. And that's different, I think, though, in terms of the basic platform from which we step. I mean, it seems to me if you have a bunch of claim-specific affirmative defenses, then maybe they're subject to those. So maybe the jury's verdict may be reconciled on the ground that they credited certain of those affirmative defenses. Can you explain to me then, because again, I think it's the finding that's troubling for your client is not the first one, but it's the second one. not that there was a contract, but rather that he proved his claim for breach of contract as stated. Can you reconcile the jury's verdict giving the severance pay and not giving the retention bonus?
Mr. Honor, I would liken it to, if Your Honor loses your job tomorrow, certain things, you will get $100. Okay, and if you don't lose your job tomorrow, you don't get the $100. But if you lose your job at any time in the future, you will get A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And I think that's what happened here. I think that's the most reasonable inference. But again, we don't need to, we can't sit in the jury room, obviously deliberations are sacrosanct. And as much as I wanted to when I was trying cases with the Air Force JAG, I wanted to hear what they would say to learn from that. We don't know, it's sacrosanct. But Your Honor, we think that every reasonable inference that can be drawn interprets or would lead to that interpretation. That's what they did.
Can you square that with the finding that if the position were eliminated at any time, then the terms and conditions contained in the March 2004 Memorandum of Understanding would be honored?
Well, that, one other thing on Instruction 11 before I get to that. Your Honor, there is a pending motion before this court for remand based on what happened on September 9, 2009. We don't know what happened on that date. That was the day, one of the 2 days we discussed jury instructions. And although the plaintiff indicated they made a contemporaneous objection to instruction 11 at the time it was given, which is of course required, we do not necessarily believe that's the case. We asked the court to remand that to the trial court to require plaintiff to determine exactly what happened on September 2009 in accordance with Appellate Rule 10. That did not happen. That remains pending, but we really don't think we need a remand. So going to your question, Your Honor, I think the best way, again, to determine this is we can't attach too much attention or importance to the word the. Read that alone in paragraph 1. Divorce it from the special verdict form that we have that says certain terms and conditions, and also divorce it from the manner in which the case was tried, and that was a la carte per plaintiff's exhibit 36. You've got A, B, C, D, pick one. Of the things that they picked, the jury said, we'll pick B. And we're gonna say that if your job were eliminated at any time, you get severance pay. But sorry, if your job was not eliminated in 2004, you do not get a retention bonus. You do not get the notice, the 30 days notice. And that is,
pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Taravella, but at this point, I think it's ripe to go to the hypothetical I asked opposing counsel. Why is it a wrong thing if the jurors unanimously agree that there was a breach for them to sit in the jury room and engage in horse trading over, I think he ought to get X, no, I think he ought to get Y, okay, let's agree on Z. Tell me why that's the wrong thing.
I think when it gets to damages, it's a horse of a different color, Your Honor, with all due respect. I think on damages, we're not sure again what the jury did, but it was tried a la carte. It looks like they awarded severance pay. The reason I say it looks like that is if you look at the menu, that's the exact amount the plaintiff requested. Okay, I don't think that's a compromise verdict, though, for the jury to sit there in the deliberation room and say, you know, he didn't prove his damages beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't want to give him $100. I want to give him $50. Well, what is the 30-day notice provision worth? Is it worth 1 day for every day that you were not retained beyond the 30-day notice provision? I don't know. There was no evidence introduced at trial as to that. So I would respectfully disagree that would necessarily be a compromise verdict with what counsel said. It's a damages issue. The case law in Colorado is replete with supporting a jury verdict based on damages issues and what the jury finds in damages, absent something just totally off the wall, totally unsupported by the evidence, which clearly is not what happened here. Now, Your Honor, if I can just transition, I think that there are three issues before this court that lend itself well to what I would call issues of law. Thus far, we just discussed issues of fact. It appears the plaintiff is unhappy with what the jury did. The plaintiff did not get everything he asked. He had his day in court, hotly contested facts, retention bonus. We spent so much time at trial. What is a retention bonus? Do you get it if you lose your job, or do you get it if you keep your job? As it turned out, the evidence in trial indicated that it depends. on the economic circumstances. Having said that, I think there are three issues before the court that lend themselves to issues of law. One is the Genesis time off and the plaintiff's request that Genesis time off, that the use it or lose it policy be held invalid per se, void in Colorado. The second is the after acquired evidence doctrine that's before the court, and the issue there is, will the court be willing to extend the after acquired evidence doctrine to issues not involving resume fraud? There's a note 12 in one of the cases we cited that basically says we're going to hold after acquired evidence in Colorado to resume fraud. And third is the attorney's fees, and whether or not we should be awarded attorney's fees under the Colorado Wage Claim Act. With respect to the first issue, the Genesis time off, we would respectfully submit it's not ripe, it's not a good case. Bad facts make bad law. And here's why. Genesis time off was not just vacation pay, which clearly is wages under the Colorado Wage Claim Act. Okay, it also includes holiday pay, sick pay, personal vacation time, personal time, that in addition to vacation pay, number one. Number two is the meaning of accrued was hotly contested at trial. The court basically found, well, accrued is subject to the carryover policy. There's an 80-hour carryover policy. Three is Jeanette, a vice president of facilities management, each year asked that the court waive its 80-hour use-it-or-lose-it policy, and each year he was denied. So I would submit to you, Your Honor, that we don't need to make new law in this area. We just probably, I would respectfully submit to the court, just go with the law as it is here today. With respect to the after-acquired evidence doctrine, Your Honors have an opportunity here to basically say that due to the evidence that was acquired after the fact, that is, after Jeanette was terminated, that basically the employer is correct, and the employer wins as a matter of law. This is an opportunity for this court to extend the after acquired evidence doctrine to cases that involve more than resume fraud or fraud in the inducement, as the court appears to look at it.
This argument you have raised sort of this in a small cross appeal, right?
It is.
To this issue.
Yes, sir. We would like you to affirm the jury verdict. Yes. It's a defensive cross appeal, if you will.
And and enforce it part of specific damage, additional, that wouldn't necessarily implicate the issue that you've got here. This would arise only if we have a new trial.
If the court awarded or was inclined to rule in favor of the after acquired evidence doctrine, there'd be no trial. As a matter of law, I think you would say that the employer wins. Under the after acquired evidence doctrine. There's ample evidence in the record to show in an offer of proof that that's what would have happened. Had Genesis known about the conduct that is briefed, and I really don't want to go into here before the court, had Genesis known about it, they unequivocally would have terminated Mr. Jeanette.
Maybe for a motion for summary judgment, but that we wouldn't be making the determination about the significance of that fact in the first instance.
I think there's ample evidence to support that, Your Honor, because basically the offer of proof was that had they known about it, Mr. Beaton, our Rule 615 witness at trial, said that had he known about it, they would have terminated him. I think you can do that. I suppose it could be done by remand as well, Your Honor, but I think you could do that. I think you have ample evidence before you to do that. And finally, the attorney's wages of the Colorado Wage Claim Act, Your Honors, the statute, as you know, 8-4-101 at SAC, basically says that if the employee did not receive wages, or did not receive a sum, it says, a sum more than at trial than he was offered, then the employer may be, it's discretionary, I will admit, but the employer gets attorney's fees. And we submit to you in this case, and there's evidence that we cited, a case law we cited in Colorado to support the proposition that in this case, Genesis should have been awarded its attorney's fees. Whether or not you look at the sum awarded as in wages or not, he got zero wages, by the way. Mr. Jeanette was awarded zero in wages. So based on that, we think there's more than ample evidence to support what happened here and more than ample evidence to award us attorney's fees.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's the award of attorney's fees, the statute does say may, number one. And number two, the Wage Act was not designed to discourage plaintiffs or employees from bringing valid wage claims. And there certainly is no basis in this case for an award of attorney's fees. It would not require making new law to award the vacation pay as required under the party's agreement here. That's an alternative argument in that once vacation pay is awarded or pay is awarded, it can't be revoked. And that's what Genesis was doing here. Simple way to avoid that, they could have had a policy that says you can accrue up to 10 hours or 10 days of vacation, and then you stop accruing. But that's not what they did. In other words, the vacation pay was earned. It was accrued and earned. At that point, it has become wages already, and they failed to structure the policy in a way that would have avoided that.
So on that last argument, did you claim in the trial court that the policy should not be enforced? Did you make that argument in the trial court?
We made the argument, Your Honor, that the agreement is the document itself, the 2004 agreement. And we also argued that it should not be enforced, yes. That policy was not relevant, that the use it or lose it provisions were not relevant.
But you didn't argue that if they applied, that they should be unenforceable?
We argued that to the judge, yes. That was one of our arguments in the 15 jury instructions, yes. Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel for their excellent arguments. This case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.